Good evening. You are listening to The Talking Show on Kaechung Radio, Chinatown's only micro-broadcasting radio station for the arts. I'm Nicholas Miller, and I am not here, as per usual, with Steve Cato.
No one knows where I am. I refuse to tell anyone where I am. I am recording in an undisclosed location that shall be disclosed, that shall remain thoroughly undisclosed, and no one will ever know. No, you will never find me. So there.
Yeah. Do you know about there's a story about one of the first adopters of cryogenic freezing for life extension out here, and he was involved in an early trial. Because people, you know, at some point it seemed like perhaps he was murdering people to freeze them. But his mother, who was very elderly, passed away, and he froze her head. And all this came to a head. sorry.
Wow, that's awful.
With his mother's freezing. And so there was like subpoenas were flying around. And I guess this was just, east of here, like in Riverside or something. And
the notorious Inland Empire cryogenics killings.
I mean, they are always in desertous places, right? It's kind of like how hydroponic tomato farms are always in the desert. And you just think, well, that doesn't make a lot of sense. But anyhow,
it really doesn't.
Yeah, I think I know that there was a hydroponic tomato plant outside of Marfa, and when I asked someone who worked there, they said that they just locked in a good water deal with, you know, the depressed county government there. They're like, if you give us, you know, half the water prices, we'll employ 60 people or something like that.
Wow. And that was all they had to do.
Yeah, that's how it worked. And they got like a 50-year lease on the water prices,
right,
or whatnot.
Right.
But anyhow, this guy, when they were searching, when they were trying to subpoena and take a look at his operation, his mother's head went missing. And he still to this day will not tell where his mother's head is, but he says it's safe.
Wow. That's what you thought of. The first thing you thought of was this man hiding his mom's head.
Well, there were, you know, like there were many forces of government trying to find this head. And just as there are many forces of government perhaps trying to find you, Steve, and you will not let anyone know where you are.
I won't tell.
neither will he. Neither will he.
It's amazing. I thought that was going in a really different direction too. There were several, like, you know, as you were telling the story, I was like, I know where this guy is. I have an idea how this is going to shake out. And then it didn't go in that direction. Then I was like, okay. It's going to shake out like this. And then it didn't shake out like that either. And then I was like, no way. I just, you know, really? And then it just kept going in another, and then I was like, and it's just, it was about the hiding. I was trying to think what part it was going to connect to the thing, to me being in a secret location.
Well,
and
I guess what I thought. I just found it peculiar when I learned of this story recently that he still will not reveal the location. But I suppose the loose accusations are that he murdered his mother, that, you know, that freezing someone is a form of murder. And the statute of limitations on murder are 100 years. So he's just keeping it zipped up, you know. Which,
yeah,
you know, when you're into freezing, these are numbers you have to worry about, you know, like,
yeah, you're playing the long game.
Yeah, 100 years, you're like, okay, I can wait, I can freeze that out. I'll chill for 100 years.
Put it on ice. All right. So in your like presumed recent research on this the Riverside cryo killer, because I would assume this is the case. You cannot actually, like, if you want, all right, so like you are the rich millionaire, you are Mr. Weyland in charge of the Weyland Yutani Corporation, you're dying of a rare disease, and you have smuggled yourself on board the ship Prometheus, you know, like your hope, right, is that not that you die and then are like somehow preserved or, you know, whatever. It's like you will be alive and then frozen, right? Like, that's how it works. Like, cause it's like, I have a rare cancer, let's say. I don't, touch wood, but say I have, and my goal is to be frozen until such a time as there is a cure, right? If I want to be revived, I have to not be dead in the first place, right?
Well, these are the muddy.
This is
waters,
why it's murder.
Yeah, that people are
right.
People are exploring. I think. Well, I think the short answer is that no one knows how reanimation works. So,
well, because it doesn't effectively, the cryogenic does kill you.
Right.
These people are chumps.
Okay. Let's say, as a thought experiment, that reanimation does work. I don't think we know the parameters involved. Like, do you need to be frozen when, with what, how, what works best? I don't think there's any idea of how that works.
Huh. You'd think they'd do a lot of this primary research on squirrels or weasels or something, and we would know.
I mean, if I have my druthers, I will be, suspended in amber. Because clearly, like in the film Jurassic Park, you can come back to life or be cloned or something. And I think it's just the amber that translucent.
Just this giant block of amber with you inside it. Like the yeah. most tree sap imaginable.
But you
like
know,
just an incredible amount of sap.
Yeah, yeah.
That's the best part, is just like gathering so much sap.
Yeah, Pasadena millionaire destroys the entire rainforest trying to encase himself in sap because of an idea he had while late night viewing of Jurassic Park.
Based on the film adaptation of Michael Crichton's novel, Jurassic Park.
Yeah. Michael Crichton wrote him personally to ask him to cease his efforts of collecting
to save the Amazon.
Yeah, to save the Amazon. But he thinks that perhaps Michael Crichton doesn't have his best interest in mind when it comes to his project.
Does anyone know what Michael Crichton's last wishes are?
Oh gosh!
Does Michael Crichton still live?
Yeah, is he the one who's really into baseball, or is that the horror fiction guy?
Stephen King?
Yeah, never mind. I think Stephen King like owns a sizable chunk of Colorado or something, and has built like a Major League Baseball style stadium for his Pee Wee team in the town he owns.
Huh.
I know this much.
Stephen King has finally left Maine, is what you're saying.
Oh, geez. Now you have me all twisted. Maybe it's Michael Crichton.
But
I don't know. I imagine Michael Crichton used to, like, can he just sit in the back of science conferences anymore? You know, like quietly taking notes on whatever the cutting edge research is?
Yeah, just to turn it into a sort of thrilling yarn.
Yeah.
I have a feeling one doesn't talk about the new Michael Crichton books. So... has he stopped? It's like, do all these guys just quit at a certain point? Like, you also, I got the impression, right, that like Dick Francis just kept going. You know, like you would go through the airport and you would look at the bookstore in the airport, see if there's anything fun to read or a magazine. And there'd always be like a new Dick Francis book. There's always a new Stephen King book, even though you're like, really? You know, like they're still cranking him out. I believe Dick Francis is now dead and his estate like writes his books, which I think is amazing.
Oh my goodness.
I think he died quite a while ago too. And it has been this way for a while now that there is no Dick Francis anymore, but there's always like Dick Francis is dead. Long live Dick Francis. There shall be more thrilling horse racing thrillers. But
Michael Crichton is no longer with us. I can say that.
Okay.
As of 2008. Okay. So yeah, it's been,
was he cryogenically preserved?
I don't think so, but he was a large art collector.
Interesting.
But you are right about these kind of writers. I think that they just, they trudge along till they meet their maker. Like Wallace Stevens, surely, just writing letters and poems till the bitter end.
Well, all right, Wallace Stevens, So the constellation we've built here is Michael Crichton, Stephen King, Wallace Stevens, Dan Brown. I mentioned Dan Brown as well.
Okay.
But I, you know, I like after two, when was his last book?
Michael Crichton's.
Yeah. It seems you have his Wikipedia page open in your, location.
Yeah. My undisclosed location. Yeah, 2009, I think they published some things posthumously.
Hmm.
I can only see fragments. It's not an appropriate time to really plumb the depths of Michael Crichton's.
I can only see fragments.
I
have a rare genetic disorder. I can only see fragments.
Yeah.
I hope to be cryogenically preserved until such time as my fragmentary vision problem can be addressed by medical science.
Well, I think, you know, now that we've built this triumvirate of novelistic genius, I think it's time to present a new kid on the block. Who I think will throw down the gauntlet of
somewhere between Wallace Stevens and Dan Brown.
Right, right. We have a good friend of the talking show, personal friend of both Steve and I's, an educator, writer, thinker,
medievalist,
and I would also say sartorial genius.
Oh, that's true.
Very true.
Great outfits.
Yeah. So we'd like to give a warm welcome this evening to Stacey Voss.
So, I have been writing new pieces, very short pieces, but it's not true that I've necessarily been writing a new piece every day. I've been posting pieces that have existed for years. So I might occasionally read the year in which the piece was written today. Otherwise, you can assume that it was written in 2020 when I decided that a fiction practice would be good to pick up during this very strange time. So I'll begin with a story from 2016, and it's dedicated to the beloved Wrigley, the member of the Stuker family who, as of yesterday, is no longer with us. On a day, the spaniel found a miniature soccer ball by the creek behind the house. Fearful that his owners might confiscate this booty, he remained in the far reaches of the yard, attempting to hide behind the trees. When, after some time, he ventured to rejoin the family on the deck, the ball remained lodged in his mouth. A difficult moment came when the son of the owners presented to the dog a single tortilla chip on the ground near his feet. The dog poked his head toward the chip, hoping to develop a second mouth for the purpose of eating the small snack, while his main mouth held the ball securely. This wish was not fulfilled, however, and instead he hit the chip with the ball, breaking it into three pieces. It was then determined by the dog that he would have to let the ball go in order to ingest the chip. As a family member reached gently for the ball to pry it loose, unsure if it had become stuck or if the dog was merely biting it fiercely, the ball at last came loose. The dog gasped for air, letting an avalanche of saliva fall to the boards of the deck. At last, the ball rolled free, while the broken chip made its way into the mouth of the dog. Two with Dorothy Wordsworth. The Cheshire word for starved. There was once a wife who was so generous to the poor people that she gave them victuals and drink. She had a passion for feeding animals, and once she killed a pig with feeding it overmuch. When she learned that the pig was dead, she said, "To be sure, it is a great loss, but I thank God it did not die clemmed." March 26, 1802. While she was getting into bed, he wrote The Rainbow. Feeding time, 2016. On the day all other staff attend a wedding for the watch repairman, the woman working at the clockmaker's shop in Oregon says over the phone, "They don't even know how many hours the donkeys have been eating the grass." Mr. Bulky. One evening in 1998, the manager at the Bolt Candy Store located in the Lansing Mall told the slender teenage girl standing next to him behind the cash register, "I like my women thick in the winter." Night Stalker, 2018. The nighttime stalker of goods, given a position through an advocate of the state, placed the groceries on the shelves carefully each shift, crackers next to chocolates, jams next to waters, teas next to napkins, beans next to noodles. One night, when the store decided never to close its doors and to serve the public 24 hours per day, a man came in down the very aisle where the stalker was stalking and pulled from the shelf one of the items for eventual sale. What the stalker knew was how to place the items and how to keep them in place. Crackers next to chocolates, jams next to waters, teas next to napkins, beans next to noodles. When he saw the item dislodged, pulled from its rightful place where he had set it only moments before, he knew just what he had to do. He punched the man, the can snatcher, in his face. Later, when told he may no longer stock the shelves of the store, he explained his position. "I've been putting these things on the shelves for years. All of a sudden, he comes in and takes them off." The Keys to the Buttery. She prayed her husband, as soon as he came to her, that she might have the keys of the buttery to take her meat and drink as she had done before. Steve's, 2014. The owner and the worker at the pizza shop make a bet. This week, Steve M. had only ordered one pie, but he always orders three, they knew. So they wagered. "This was a different Steve," said the owner. "No," said the employee, "it's Steve M." They bet on a candy bar. When they confirmed that it was a different Steve, and when the employee guessed which Steve, he wanted to renegotiate the terms of the original bet. "I should get something," he said. "I guessed which Steve it was, out of all of the Steves." A question posed by one user of the internet to another. "Did you even read the article, Derek?" You know what? Can I ask the panelists to unmute themselves so I can hear human life? Thank you. Great. A note on the city librarian of Bridgeport, Connecticut, 2014. Tawana, standing outside the community college, took a long drag from her cigarette before declaring, "I know Scott Hughes personally." That's a true story, by the way, and some people who are here have already looked it up. Scott Hughes, the Bridgeport City Librarian. Information shared upon an inquiry about a grocery clerk whose name was something like Lynn or Dawn. Gail, who once left Minnesota to follow her therapist to San Diego, has now left San Diego and returned to Minnesota. Cornell Funeral. An esteemed literary critic spoke a line in the eulogy that prompted several attendees, his students, in one row, to turn around and look at those in the row behind them, silently nodding with satisfied smiles, as if to acknowledge their shared reference, if not their shared loss of a life. Noise complaint keyed to genre. There was a certain flourish to the letter the neighbors submitted to the owners of the building that housed the St. Andrews Society in the historic Italian neighborhood of the crime-ridden New England city. Complaining of the noise emanating from the apartment just a few feet from their own, they wrote that they had tired of having to shield themselves from the sounds of Natalie Merchant each time the female tenant, whose name they knew but misspelled, was, as they put it, moved by the spirit. The sounding of clogs. I love your clogs, she said from the end of the olive bar. Are they Dr. Scholl's? When I was young, I had the white ones. I used to wake up at night just to see if they were still there. I like the sound, she said slowly, almost so quietly that the clog wearer repeated, the sound, while stomping her foot lightly, olives in her hand. Two at home. The construction worker, whom had been flagged down by a woman with a dead car battery, or she feared worse, assured her that the use of his jumper cables, as opposed to her own, was no trouble. He was used to pulling out cords and tools on a regular basis. I've got two at home, he said. And by this, he didn't mean two cars. Rather, he had two women at home who, like all other women he would encounter, sought help from the member of the other sex whenever they had dead car batteries or they often feared something worse. Serial affinity. When she saw the other woman wearing the exact shirt she cherished, a sheer cream-colored mix of cotton and wool, and when she saw that the woman's shirt had hardly been worn, while hers had been worn often and torn much, so that the chest of it bore three evenly spaced holes, she said to the woman, I have that same shirt, and it's my favorite, but mine is torn. To which the woman replied, with a smacking of the tongue and an exclamation like one issued out of frustration, it comes distressed. A father-in-law, once an instructor of rhetoric, shares his teaching philosophy in a single sentence. If you think that ethos, logos, and pathos are the names of the three musketeers, I haven't done my job and you haven't done your job. Plus one, a statement from Mary Norris. Commas, like nuns, often travel in pairs. Out of the office. The lecturer, whose teaching ended for the week every Wednesday, often wished her colleagues a good weekend, since she would not see them on Friday, when it would be customary to utter this polite, if empty, phrase. But when she said this to the departmental secretary, who would be tethered to her desk for two more long days before considering the week's end, her attempt at conviviality was met with reproach. Weekend, the assistant replied, turning her head away from her large monitor, projecting above the mood-enhancing music she often played in the office, the music one heard at a massage studio that served only female divorcees. The lecturer tried to recover from her mistake of suggesting that any respectable person could consider Wednesday at 4 o'clock the end to the work week. Oh, I just won't see you on Friday, so I thought I'd say it now. This had no great effect, as the woman at the desk, the seeker of peace, replied with an ascending tone and a drawn out, okay. The next day, the lecturer received an email composed on the same large monitor stating, attention faculty, Cynthia will be out of the office on Friday, March 29. Returns. A student in the eighth grade announced one afternoon, you can Google, Google. Procession. In the mornings when he went to surf, he could not see through the fog the lines separating the ground from the sea, sea from sky. You're just following the sound, he said. Transplant. Her body is rejecting California, she says, her legs in yoga pants outstretched and resting upon a bench in one of the many improvised shopping malls in La Jolla. She has stuffed her ears with electronic buds so as to hear her friend, who is represented in 3x5-inch form on her phone. And despite this small format, an onlooker can see the friend's neon green nails when she lifts her hands to her face. The young woman projects her voice, imagining that she needs to compensate for the use of wires and internet connectivity when trying to reach her friend. And though her voice can be heard from a distance, throughout the entire duration of the lunch of the solitary diner nearby, she nonetheless concludes at one point in the call, "I just feel like I need to be quiet, you know?" The doves, according to Jeff. The male dove is building a nest that the female dove feels he should have built positively days ago. A lonely. As she called out to her husband in the other room to tell him of the early form of the English word for lonely, which combined alone and lonely, in order to make a word that now read like the phrase all lonely, but actually meant at once all and only, she was left as one only, alone with her announcement, waiting amid silence. A saint gains passage. When Saint Mary of Egypt saw the men boarding the ship, she prayed them that she might go with them, and that they should not refuse her. And by many lewd and foul words, she moved them to laugh. Then they took her into their ship. Thank you. And I'm going to turn it back over to my host now for some talking.
Thanks for that, Stacy.
Yeah, thank you so much.
Wow, that was fantastic. Yeah, it's nice to see. We know Stacy as a. As a
you don't know me. You don't know where I am.
We don't know where he is. We know Stacy as a medievalist and scholar and sartorial genius. And she was writing, but that's our first full intake of Stacy's work, and that was really special. And also on the talking show, we hear all kinds of talking, lots of readings. It was a refreshing bit of anonymity in those stories, kind of like you know when they publish dream journals.
I
have to admit the only one I know well is Adorno's. So maybe this isn't widespread in dream journal publication, but all the names are obscured with initials. Which creates a kind of nice experience of a silhouette that I fill in myself. You're like, who is this woman he took a walk in this giant field with?
You know, and I think also in terms of human presence in dreams, sometimes you will have an individual rendered obviously like very clearly for you.
Mm-hmm.
But then like I find people and places tend to shift around a lot in dreams as well.
Yeah.
So it's like a situation where the sort of silhouette surrounding that, you know, who are these people, or also just people being referred to based on their job, or their sort of professional role in terms of why they're interacting with the narrator or how the narrator comes to know about them, being sort of like. Something where like a possibility of sort of sliding from one state to another exists because, you know, none of the other elements are sketched in really, or the anonymity is preserved. Also about sort of the employment details and scant naming also reminds me of German newspapers.
Mm.
Where there's a rule in Germany that you cannot, it's different here, right? Because it's like here someone does a crime, and
like lop off their mother's head and freeze it,
for example, which might not even be a crime, but someone is alleged to have done a crime, and we can immediately discuss the allegations of crime doing.
Mm-hmm.
And if the crime is really serious or really sensational, we can discuss things about their life, you know, that they had these experiences or were associated with these other people or involved in these things, had posted about these things on their Facebook, etc. And in Germany, I think, I'm not quite sure in reaction to what, but they aren't allowed to fully identify people in these situations, which I think it's also true of the victims as well. So the crime reports are just like a report of a situation that occurred, and people are identified by like their first name and last initial. So like Ulrich X is accused of having, you know, decapitated his still living mother and frozen her head.
Mm. I know Ulrich X.
His mother, you know, Jurgetha X. Anyway, things of that nature, things like that. And so as long as it's happening, and I think obviously if it's happening in a small enough community, you know who all these people are, because you're like, I saw that guy get taken away by the cops. I know who we're talking about.
Yeah. Or if you know someone named Ulrich, and then, you know, his mother's
not coming by the shop anymore. Yeah,
yeah, her name was Ursula or whatever. Then, yeah, you know, it's probably going to be him.
Yeah.
Wait, is it always the letter X, or is X a placeholder?
No, it's the first initial of their last name.
And you know, that's tantalizingly close to the whole picture, right?
You know, and I think I think only in sort of like a more modern version of the world is that actually anonymizing.
Yeah.
Right. And also actually, I think the other thing is that it's both like anonymizing, but it's also anonymizing towards a majoritarian population.
Right.
Because it's like, how many Manfreds and Ulrichs are there in Cologne? Tons.
Yeah.
You know, but if you had a more exotic name, if you were
Rigoberto,
of a different background, yeah, people, you would stand out more, and people would be like, that guy is Japanese. So it's interesting, you know, or whatever. Rigoberto. So it's interesting what conditions have to be in place, rather, I'm stumbling here, but what conditions have to be in place for something like anonymity to occur,
mm-hmm.
you know, or what has to be assumed in order for something to feel anonymous, which is, I think, what's interesting about the dream space, right? Is because it's like, and the connection to dreams, is because you would have to be, you know, there's sort of a deracinated floating quality. And that's why people don't adhere to that kind of solid identity in dreams, because mm-hmm. like the context sort of produces those identities in the first place, I guess.
You know, it's interesting that you mentioned the German newspaper, the crime section, because when I heard that, I immediately thought of the way in which in Stacy's stories, I feel like, you know, the person often has an occupation that's laid out before you.
Mm-hmm.
And they always talk. They always make some kind of utterance, I think, or many of them do, you know, the stockman said this or whatever.
Yeah.
But the utterance is always a kind of crime, right? It's always like a, it's like it cuts through the air, whatever is being said.
Mm.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, the one about the grocery stocker is also action packed.
True. True. It's true.
But yeah. I have to say, not knowing what Stacy's fiction was like before we, before the reading, I was slightly hoping for, I don't know. I guess it would be cheesy if it had happened, but you know, like an Umberto Eco style Name of the Rose setting.
Okay.
Right. I'm always, I love the Middle Ages. I love thinking about the way that, you know, humans who are like so grindingly similar, you know, we're like, we really don't do very many things, and lots of the things we do them in ways that are like extremely predictable. And I'm very excited. I was very excited for some. So when things are different, you know, they're really, really different. And there's like some medieval stuff where there was like, I know that Stacey runs a sort of a medievalist think tank. And
wow, that's quite a term.
I had overheard from another think tank member who you will also never find in another subsequently other from this undisclosed location.
Yeah, but now that we know that there's the silhouette is sharpening, Steve, of where you're located, now we've got plenty of information.
But there was discussion of these sort of like effigies of Christ that were made out of human skin that were, I guess,
Mamma mia,
relatively common in certain aspects of certain medieval societies. I imagine there's like tight geographical limits on this, but you know, maybe I lack the details, but maybe this is like something where like certain Flemish towns, major Flemish market towns, this was common or something, or in parts of Spain. I don't know.
Was it a source of great pride to be the flayed person, or was it kind of like how we, you know, like how prisons are slave camps now, where they just,
I'm not sure. And I'm not sure if it was necessarily even done from one person.
Oh, okay.
Maybe they just put them together.
A collage, if you will.
A collage. And, you know, it's just like the kind of thing where it's like, well, we pretty much do all the same things as we did then. You know, like you eat, you sleep. But then every now and again, there's something like really wild where they're like, oh, yeah. And then we have this sort of morbid effigy that's part of our town as well, and we do special things with it. Or like, yes, sure, but all of our food economy is based on eels or something.
Right.
And you're like, really? And they're like, just like, yeah, it's like really important. The eels are the most important thing. And like, for someone like me, an eel is something you eat maybe twice a year. You know, Japanese teriyaki eel.
Okay. Never a year, and I don't do eel. But
really?
No. No.
How often do you eat eel?
Never.
Oh, never a year. You. Yeah.
Nary a year have I ever had eel.
Well, they are a freaky creature because they all go to the Sargasso Sea to mate, and they are capable of transitioning from being freshwater to saltwater animals, which is like almost impossible given how most fish's bodies are constructed. And just the idea that, like, you know, your common everyday Dutch eel, where I understand the sort of conditions in Holland are ideal for eels, that they travel so far just to bone and then come back.
Yeah.
Mind-blowing. Mind-blowing that these creatures exist. Mind-blowing that they have evolved to do this using the earth. And then mind-blowing subsequently that, like, a significant portion of the Dutch economy for hundreds of years was based on commerce surrounding them, and you could pay rent in eels.
Oh,
yeah. But then, and also, like, what's crazy is, like, so you could pay rent in eels, but like if I could pay rent in something, I could go to a local nearby waterway and like hang out and use a special sort of tool to catch
a grabber,
an eeling wand or whatever. If like, isn't that wild? Like, just how much we've enclosed the economy, so to speak, you know, through primitive accumulation or what have you.
Yeah.
In such a way where, like, you know, you would, if you owed someone money, that you could be like, I owe Steve some money, so and it doesn't look like any of my my barrel making business is doing great, so I'm not going to come into money that way. I'm just going to kick it down to the pond an eel for a couple days, you know, and like think my thoughts, eel, and hopefully I'll get enough eels that I can pay Steve back. Like,
well, I'm sure it had to be treacherous to some degree, right? Or was just the wealth disparity so great that just the wealthy were like, I don't want to go do that now. So I'll happily waive your rent for an eel.
Yeah, I think that's kind of it. I think it's like they're like, I don't want to go eeling. And they're like, you know, but like, honestly, as a largely unemployed person, like, I feel like I could squeeze in an eeling session if eels were about and if it was economically useful. You know, I would gladly, you know, sort of rent's coming due. What am I going to do with my time? I'm going to go catch some eels, you know, and like wake up early, see the sunrise, you know, if early is the best time to catch eels, which I'm not clear on either.
I think you should brush up on some of those details before you start trying to pay rent and eel.
My friend Nathan has been crabbing lately in Northern California, and that sounds delightful.
Oh.
And you get crab, which is also, which rules.
Yeah, I wouldn't eat the eel, but I like the taste of crab.
You know, and you're right to not want to eat the eel because they are bottom feeders and they're picking up all kinds of stuff down there.
Yeah. Ugh. Ugh.
Ah, they're delish. Barbecued? Mm. One day I'll have to take you for the best eel in town when indoor dining resumes. You'll be... I challenge you to... They're a little bony, but I challenge you to not eat it with relish.
Yeah.
I won't tell you what it is.
Well, after our residency at the French Laundry, it's going to be hard to to eat anything anything not... You know, anything that doesn't come with a songbird melted on top. It's going to be quite tough.
Yeah. Well, you know, I hear that their eel terrine is to die for at French Laundry. So
you did get that many times.
And it was an opportunity you missed. I wondered why you were never ordering it, but now I know.
No, I was just drinking wine from the barrel.
Well, all right. I've certainly worked up an appetite. I'm sure our audience is now also famished. After all this eel talk.
Yeah. Or frozen from the intro. Yeah.
Yeah. Or indeed dried and preserved somehow and hanging out inside a medieval cathedral.
Yeah. So whether you're chilling or flayed, thank you for watching. Listening.
Thank you for watching.
Thank you for watching. Well, hopefully you're watching the air jiggle with our voices.
That's
not the best way to take in the talking show. The best way
is directly at your speakers.
Yeah, stare at them. Watch
the whole
air
time
jiggle.
We talk.
A better way to enjoy the talking show is just use the big chunks of flesh on either side of your head and listen. Thanks again, Stacy. That was
thank you so
great
much.
To have you. And
what a pleasure.
As always, the talking show signing off. Good morning, Chinatown.
See you next Wednesday.